The year is 1330, and England has a new king. A king like no other. For much of the history of England since this man died, Edward III was seen as the greatest king England ever had, period. He was the dude. He was the one basically all later kings held as the high point of English kingliness. And this reputation kind of lasted him all the way until about the 18th century. And right about then, historians decided, it was all hype. They didn't like him at all. And since then, there was an erosion of his reputation and his glory. Right about now, well, you can read and find accounts of him that portray him as everything from a bloody despot to the perfect medieval king. It was in him that so much of what we today know as England and Englishness really comes from. He is somewhat of a game changer, from the use of our language to the developments of our culture. Hell, this is a guy who introduced a foreign saint to become the patron saint of England. Edward III was to be the king who would instigate the 100 Years' War, who would steer England through the Black Death, and whose legacy was to change the future of the nation irrevocably. When we think of medieval English kings, he's the template. This is the one. But since this is a linear story, we have to ask, what was he like when he first arrived, this Thunderbolt? What kind of personality did he have? And how was this to impact upon London? Because it's worth remembering, as we've covered over the last, 100 chapters or so, London and the kings of England, they clashed. They clashed a lot. I mean, without naming the episodes, regular listeners will know that London had opposed William of Normandy. It had been occupied by him. They'd been okay under his sons and had gained a decent charter out of Henry I. But then the city had sided and chosen King Stephen to be King of England, opposing Matilda. And then after that, and the powerful reign of Henry II, they found themselves politically and then militarily opposed to King John. And this had gone from helping form the Magna Carta to inviting a Frenchman called Louis to take the throne instead of him. John's son, Henry III, also didn't seem to get on that. Led to the city being stalwarts of the rebellions of Simon de Montfort and then Gilbert de Clare. And while they'd been cowed by his son, Edward I, as we've just covered over a bunch of chapters, by the time Edward II was on the throne, they were siding against him a lot. So it would be nice if the city could find a king they could get on with. Maybe. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that attempts to tell the complete history of the city from the point of view of Londoners at the time. It takes a narrative approach to history as it tries to explain what Londoners cared about at the time we're talking about. Now, the podcast does talk about wider historical events, but I make no bones about being utterly biased towards London and its streets and its residents and its politics above the rest of the country. Each episode fits within a giant narrative and is divided into chapters which make up this mammoth and grand tale. And yet the aim is to try and make each week stand alone. And so this chapter is one where we introduce this teenage king and start looking at his impact upon London. It's also the story of how he ended up organising one of London's most majestic moments that led to a terrible accident that almost threatened the fate of the realm itself. Welcome, then, to the 118th chapter of this story of London, a near disaster on Cheapside. So, in order to understand why London switched from being in, like, total political chaos to suddenly seeming all calm under this new king, we have to spend a bit of time getting to know this new king. In a nation where politics was so intimately shaped by a few individuals, this individual is all important. And so if you'll indulge me for a moment, there is much about this king that is fascinating. And it's really important to learn about the influences upon him as he takes up the throne. England in the early part of the 14th century was a country in which the future and the past were interwoven with the present. They thought differently about time and about the idea of now. People at the time believed in prophecy. The future was, like the past, a liminal space, this filled with hope instead of memory. All the great families of England knew their history, none more so than the royal family, and they believed that to a certain extent they could know their futures too. They could know their futures as well, through the power of prophecy. Now, prophecy is not personal fortune telling. It's a public act. It is a declaration of what we believe the future will be, and it's usually circulated by word of mouth, and occasionally it was written down, and every so often somebody added them to literary works. And the most widely circulated prophecy of this time was something known as the Prophecy of the Six Kings, which predates the birth of Edward, but was probably first written down in its earliest form about the time Edward III was born. This Prophecy of the Six Kings prophesizes, or reflects, upon the six kings that were to come after King John. And it characterizes six kings by describing them as animals. Henry III was portrayed as a lamb. Edward I was seen as a dragon. Edward II was seen as a goat. And Edward III was prophesied to become, quote, the boar that will come out of Windsor, unquote. Although a boar or wild pig might not strike the modern listener as an animal of any great significance, this particular beastie had huge resonance in the 14th century because there was a political figure with a similar nickname around this time, the boar who came out of Cornwall. And that other person was none other than the mythical figure of King Arthur. Moreover, this the boar who will come out of Windsor was, according to the prophecy, to have a head and heart of a lion, would wear three crowns, a reference to the three crowns of the Holy Roman Empire, and would be buried in Cologne amongst the tombs of the three kings, or the Magi, who were said to be the first ever Christian kings. To those who heard the prophecy, the future was clear. Edward II, the bleating goat, would lose his kingdom. After his death, his successor, Edward of Windsor, would win fame as a warrior king, become Holy Roman Emperor, and win battles across Europe, regaining the lands which his ancestors had lost. The people of England could have some faith that their newborn prince would grow up to not just be a king, but a lion-hearted and victorious one. The large numbers of copies of this prophecy allow us to be reasonably confident that Edward probably knew about it. His mother had a copy of it. And later in life, Edward specifically renounced any intention of being buried at the Shrine of the Three Kings in Cologne, which is a bit of a giveaway. Now, I'm not saying he believed in the prophecies about him. We do not know if he took such things seriously. We know his father did. We know that Richard II once wrote to the Pope asking if the reason why everything seemed to go wrong with him because he failed to follow these precise instructions in something called the Prophecy of the Earl of St. Thomas. But in an age where most people believed in destiny, Edward III would have understood that it was widely held that he would become a military conqueror abroad and a champion of the church, a man whose leadership had been awaited for centuries. It was an utterly traditional role for a king, very similar to that of his grandfather, the majestic and fearsome Edward I. But it was also wrapped up in contemporary ideas of romance and religious mysticism. And all of this, combined with new ideas about how kings should act and be, were definitely an influence upon the impressionable teenager as he approached his own majority as king. Another huge influence upon the younger King Edward was his experience of Europe. It's worth saying that Edward's mother, Queen Isabella, Isabella the Fair, was not just famed for her beauty and intelligence. She was also simply famed for being connected to most of the royal houses of Europe. Her mother had enjoined the title of Countess Palatinine of Champagne and Brie, as well as Queen of Navarre. Through that link, she was connected to the Iberian royal families. Her grandmother was related to the Dukes of Brabant. Her cousin, the daughter of Charles, Count of Wah, was related to William, Count of Hainault, Holland and Zeeland, the Lord of Friesland. Put simply, Queen Isabella was immersed in a complex series of dynastic relationships across the whole of Europe, while Edward II's only living close European relative was his nephew, the young Duke of Brabant. The reason for this disparity was brutal. Despite two centuries of English kings marrying continental brides, England remained on the periphery of the continental dynastic network. France, respected as the most powerful kingdom in Christendom, was at the very centre of it. Thus, for young Edward of Windsor, his mother represented rich dynasties and royal links far beyond the shores of this island. It is said, apparently, that at his baptism, Isabella's uncle had suggested that the Queen should name her firstborn son Louis, so as to better fit in with his European relatives. Not surprisingly, the English insisted upon Edward. But that foreign link would have made a huge impression upon Edward. And the best example would have been when he was still heir. Prince Edward had made his way to the Royal Palace near Paris to perform homage to King Charles of France. And as he travelled through the French countryside, the country folk had flocked to see him. After all, here he was, the son of their Princess Isabella, the grandson of King Philip the Fair, the nephew of King Charles the Fair, the great-great-grandson of Saint Louis, the famous crusading king of France. To the French people, attractiveness, holiness, and royalty were all seen as hallmarks of the French royal family. So every single member of that dynasty was a spectacle to be seen, a spiritual marvel to be witnessed. Politically as well, Edward, when he turned up, was important. Isabella had maintained her French links, visiting France on several occasions, and had attracted considerable sympathy when she had been neglected by her husband in favour of Piers Gaveston. This appearance in France of her firstborn son and heir to the English throne, simply put, was not to be missed. As Edward proceeded across France, he was surrounded by crowds, showering him in adulation and awe. This was to have an incredible impact upon the young king-to-be, one that will be kind of important going forward. The third influence upon this young king was his mother's lover, Roger de Mortimer. You got to understand, well, last chapter I went on about how much Mortimer had become the power in the regime. Put simply, you could reasonably argue that he was attempting to make the young Edward III nothing more than just a figurehead, a symbolic king, while he retained all the power. I mean, it has to be said that what he actually had done to Edward II was, in fact, arguably the smoothest coup d'etat in English history. And from the word go, Mortimer was setting himself up for the long haul. I mean, take, for example, the idea that Mortimer had fixed the date for the coronation of Edward III before Parliament had even decided to get rid of Edward II. Mortimer wanted a quick coronation to confirm the official status of what was effectively his administration. For the same reason, he made sure that all the coronation agreements were done and it should be an amazingly splendid act that the king could just, you know, ride along in. Edward had been dressed in the traditional red samite. Striped cloth lined his path from the palace to the abbey. As he walked along it, surrounded by cheering crowds, with at least 10 bishops and many earls and other lords and ladies, he was accompanied by 4 knights who held a gold panoply festooned with bells over his head. In the abbey, the floor was covered in cloth, and the stage, especially created for the occasion before the high altar, was covered in quilted gold silk. In fact, practically everything at the eastern end of the abbey was covered in gold. On the stage, the king sat on a gilded throne with gold cushions beneath his feet and gold cloth beneath the cushions, a gold scepter in one hand, a gold orb in the other, and a gold crown upon his head that had formerly belonged to the saint King Edward the Confessor. The hangings of the canopy above him were all golden. The Archbishop of Canterbury sat on a seat covered in gold. To anyone staring along the nave, as Latin chants echoed around those arches in that abbey, the king would have appeared as a sole man in red at the centre of a dazzling celestial apparition in which golden figures moved around him across a golden space and performed the ritual anointing and coronation with golden vassals and golden regalia. Crucially, however, amongst all this grandeur, Mortimer had insisted that Edward III swore the four oaths of his coronation. He promised to confirm the laws and customs of the people of England. He promised to observe the rights of the church. He promised to do justice equally to all his people. But then he also promised, quote, to hold and keep the rightful laws and customs that the community of the realm shall choose, and to defend and strengthen them, unquote. Now, I mentioned this in a previous episode, but this fourth clause of the coronation oath had been added specifically to use against Edward II. It was designed to preserve the power of Parliament from the encroachments of the kings of England. And its repetition in Edward III's coronation was basically Mortimer applying the same safeguards unto his son. Parliament had reasons for this to remain. Yet in all of these events, from early 1327, from the disposition of his father to his own coronation, one senses a certain distance in the young king. He seems to be going along for the ride. He doesn't seem to have any major say in what was happening. I mean, Mortimer turned up and his sons were dressed as earls, which was a really symbolic thing, because traditionally the only people who could dress as earls were the sons of the king. There was great pomp and circumstances and lavish feasting, but the king really did nothing except sit there and witness. Mortimer was the man in charge of all ways during his coronation and immediately after him becoming king. And this loss of power was to influence much of Edward's mindset in the years to come. The fourth big influence upon the king during those early years of his reign was war. Edward seemed from a young age desperate to go out and fight somebody. He'd been prophesied as a great warrior king, so he chafed at those who restrained him. But during his early reign, the king had a humbling experience up in Scotland. The king and Roger Mortimer had marched north with an army to take on the Scottish forces in that perennial and eternal war that seemed to take place up there. It should be noted, and I will mention more of this next chapter, that at least 500 Londoners went with the Royal Army, no doubt happily supplied by the pro-Mortimer regime of Mayor Bethume, and these Londoners would have witnessed firsthand what was to follow. When the campaign really started, a game of cat and mouse followed, as the young king was eager to attack the Scottish, but the Scottish weren't so eager to meet his army, and Roger Mortimer was unwilling to risk the life of the young king. After a few inconclusive skirmishes, the mainstay of the English forces decide that they would besiege the mainstay of the Scottish forces. That was much safer than a battle, and one was set up. Edward was frustrated that he was being denied a battle in which he could prove himself as king. But while the siege was in place, the Scots struck. One Scottish leader, a man called Sir James Douglas, the infamous Black Douglas, led 200 men on a daring nighttime raid onto the unsuspecting English camp. Most of the Englishmen were asleep, and suddenly the Scots were amongst them, slashing the ropes of their tents and thrusting down with spears on the sleeping men caught beneath the tangled canvas ropes and poles. The leaders of the English force were sleeping in their armour and were quickly awake, but they couldn't really organise any resistance. Many men were slain. Edward himself was badly shaken, for as he slept, apparently Black Douglas cut the ropes supporting his pavilion. The Scottish plan had been to capture the young king, but one of his chaplains within the tent managed to conceal him, saving him from the humiliation of being kidnapped. All through the camp, the cries of, quote, a Douglas, you shall all die, English thieves, unquote, rang out and caused terror. And then, as quickly as it arrived, Douglas and the Scotsman left the English to tend to their wounded men as they lay screaming, dying off their wounds in the night. And for Edward, it was a startling introduction to the realities of war. He had actually come close to being killed, and he had seen and heard men butchered all around him. He got to witness the dead, the grass being soaked with their blood as the sun arose. The sight must have been hideous. But in his comprehension of war and his duty, what he perceived to be required was not a man who would shirk away from the sight of death, but a man who would lead his men despite such horrors. So completely did Edward believe in his duty to lead a fighting nation that that actual battle he saw himself as a failure at. The English around him didn't see it that way. Yes, they'd launched the night attack, but the Scots had run off. Allowing the enemy run off, Edward saw as a defeat. And when a few days later the Scots once again tricked the English and escaped by night, leaving their leather cauldrons bubbling with stewed meat in a final insult, the young king apparently broke down and wept in frustration. He would never again allow himself to be ruled so. Clearly the king sought to increase his martial prowess. This was to be a crucial lesson and influence upon him going forward. The fifth influence upon the young king was his bride. Back on January 1328, Edward had met Philippa of Hainault, his fiancée, at the gates of York. The kind and pretty Philippa was a most welcome sight to this young king. She was practically the same age as Edward, probably 18 months his junior. She was of the same blood, being his second cousin on his mother's side, but most important of all, she was temperamentally perfect for him. She had a sense of humour, she loved romances, and she displayed a sympathetic understanding of people. Side by side, they rode into the city with thousands of lords, knights, priests, and squires, and citizens of York cheering their marriage. Of course, there were tournaments that took place. Philippa watched as Edward fought with the pennons of St. George flying about him. For King Edward, the wonderful thing about Queen Philippa was the fact for the first time he had someone totally loyal in whom he could confide. His mother could read his letters, and Roger Mortimer could and did spy on his conversations. But neither of them could come between a man and his wife, and she very quickly became his support in his struggles against Mortimer's regime. And as well as that, Philippa also brought a number of young pages and Hainaultian servants who owed no allegiance to anyone but her and now her husband. One of these, a man called Walter Manny, would prove to be a lifelong friend of King Edward. All these influences then had created a bold, majestic king. And he showed what kind of man that had created when on the 26th of November 1330, Edward had Roger Mortimer dragged before Parliament, bound and gagged, and then sentenced him to death for 14 specific crimes, most of which were prefaced with the words that Mortimer had, quote, encroached the royal power, unquote. It has been generally been assumed that this marks a moment where Edward took absolute control of his kingdom. But it wasn't just black and white. Before he could recognise his ambitions, Edward had to navigate what is in effect sudden regime change. First, there was the problem of what to do with the old regime, its victims as well as its supporters, and the passions of all the people involved, which could easily lose control and make the situation far more volatile. Roger Mortimer had surrounded himself with the cleverest and most able men of his generation. Should he, as king, condemn these men? Especially when it came to the fate of his father? In the end, only two men, Roger Mortimer himself and his henchman, Simon Berriford, were executed as a result of the coup d'etat his mother had instituted. Even Roger Mortimer's sons were allowed to inherit some of their father's lands. And at this point, we discover another significant feature of Edward's character. Forgiveness. Edward was not averse to executing all his enemies, but as we will see in future events, if a man could prove useful for him, he did not let past enmity stand in the way of meaningful reconciliation. So now, this is the young king who's in charge of London and the realm in 1330. And London was now, of course, busy and changing. It had to adjust to Mortimer's time to control, and in fact Mortimer had overseen one of the largest physical changes between London and the royal family with the moving of the Great Wardrobe. The what? As I described in previous episodes, the Royal Department of the Exchequer had evolved and grown over the last few years. But alongside it had emerged a separate government department that had, especially under the reign of Edward I, become significant unto itself, the Royal Wardrobe, aka the Department of the King's Personal Affairs and Finances. Under Edward I, the Royal Wardrobe had been the financial engine of several wars and personal expenditures, and it remained a crucial aspect of royal governance. Now, the King's Wardrobe also contained something called the Great Wardrobe, which was actually simply the location where the King stored all his ceremonial robes, his clothes, his bed hangings, spare furniture, tapestries, non-precious religious items, and basically everything he owned. The Great Wardrobe was where these precious and expensive items were stored, but also repaired and maintained. Now, the Great Wardrobe had been located in Bassislaw Ward in the centre of London, but a few years earlier, Roger Mortimer and his regime had spotted a bargain, and they had relocated it to a much larger new house over in Lombard Street. See, that had been owned by a conglomerate of Lombardy merchants, and they had probably fled with the eruption of violence in London in 1326, which left it empty, which meant that Mortimer could buy it for a bargain. Henceforth, moving forward, when we talk of the Great Wardrobe, it was located here on Lombard Street. By 1331, the Mayor of London was the draper, John de Pulteney, a successful merchant, landlord and moneylender, whose moneylending activities didn't just include lending money to the King, but also to people like the Order of the Knights of St. John. Indeed, he had lent the young King money before he became mayor and had been paid off by being granted the revenues of Southampton for a short time. De Pulteney was the mayor as we come into 1331, looking towards an easy re-election and running the city as best he can. It's worth saying that in a few years, this mayor would found a College of Corpus Christi for a master and seven chaplains. This would be adjoined to the Church of St. Lawrence in today's Lawrence Pulteney Lane. And he also had a large mansion, known at the time as the Manor of the Rose. And he was running a city when along comes this complex and fun-loving king. And I've got to say, we suspect that for all the gravitas and power of his role, Edward III does appear to be somewhat fun-loving. One of our problems is that the sorts of documents which survive from the 14th century tend to be dour, you know, financial accounts, administrative records, legal rulings, royal writs, chronicles, yes, but usually written by clerks who, well, they're filled with their own morality. The weight of historical evidence always is on the side of business and propriety. Nevertheless, we can be confident that Edward was ecstatic at his success in capturing Roger Mortimer, and as soon as the man was dead, he revelled in his position as king. As Sir Thomas Grey put it, quote, "So this king led a gay life in jousts and tournaments and entertaining ladies," unquote. Edward certainly enjoyed the jousts and tournaments, which Grey mentioned, and we can point to a whole range of tournaments, games, stage battles, promenades and mass events provided by Edward for the entertainment of his citizens. These events were sometimes private for a few dozen nobles and knights, or public for a large group of people, but they all helped Edward create a new cult of kingship. They were dramatic, with the emphasis on the spectacle. For games at Guildford, around the 6th of January 1331, Edward ordered canvas and Spanish wool to be purchased in order to make deer costumes, which could be used in mock hunts to be shown in front of a crowd. And for other games, he also ordered two banners and four pennons to be made, presumably for a bunch of fake armies which would fight each other in a tournament. And one account describes him ordering, quote, 10 dozen false faces complete with beards, both for knights and squires, unquote. Yeah, he was ordering masks, and masks became a common element of his games. So too were outrageous costumes. And indeed, the nobility would often dress up as merchants or friars, devils, dragons, angels. This was to carry on for the next 20 years or so. These kind of pageants were not just occasional happenings, but regular events. Young King Edward attended some sort of games on a monthly basis in the summer and on major feast days in the winter. So a total of about 10 or 11 tournaments per year, each lasting between 2 and 4 days, would happen. And in between each of these, he'd be preparing for the next one. King Edward was clearly the guy organising the party bus. But it has to be said that, as well as the events themselves being a great spectacle, they were in many respects training exercises for real battles and duels, and also passing on a propaganda image of a romantic, chivalric life. For Queen Philippa and her ladies at court, this took the form of huge displays of wealth through their rich and varied appearance, and extravagance in practically everything they did. For Edward's knights, it took the form of regular display of prowesses in the joust and dressing up and acting as archetypal roles from popular culture and imagination. Edward was using this to recreate a semi-legendary realm. His purpose was a demonstration of absolute royalty, filled with tournaments and feasts and chivalric honour, and that harked back to one figure above all others, King Arthur. The Arthurian legends were really kicking in popularity about now. Not for the residents of England in this era, real historical figures like Pender of Mercia, the King Killer of the Midlands, whose story I mentioned all the way back in chapter 4 of this podcast. No, the utterly made-up Arthur was far more ideal. He created a perfect propaganda tool. Everything Edward III wanted to be, Arthur was. Arthurian Britain turned out to be just how 14th century England should be run. Isn't that useful? King Arthur was a one-size-fits-all device for conveying what was seen as ideal stereotypes of the nation around them. And it hadn't come out of nowhere. Arthurian tales had been slowly growing since just after the reign of Richard II, and they offered various kings a model for how they should rule, or a band of knights who would win fame, love and virtue. I mean, in his old age, Edward I had tried to create just such a band to wage war against the Scots. It never really took on because it was too large, there were over 200 knights, and his son didn't really want to carry on with it. But Edward III imagined his band of knights in a new way. If he was to be the new Arthur, then he needed a new band of close-knit, peerless knights of the Round Table. The late 13th century Round Table, which now sits in Winchester, has places for 24 knights as well as the king. Over and over again in Edward's accounts in the 1330s, we read of him ordering aikatons, which are embroidered padded tournament jackets, and tunics, which would be made for small groups of men. Edward's vision of his companionship was simple. A group of about 24 friends, brothers in arms. From the beginning of his reign, there was an attempt to make the Arthurian legends come true. If the Round Table could be made a reality, there was no reason why Edward's knights could not actually sit around it, nor any reason why they should not be as brave as the legendary knights of King Arthur. Edward III's vision of how he should be king cannot be separated from the legends of King Arthur. So important was their pull that Edward actually visited Glastonbury, Arthur's legendary burial place, soon after he took power in December 1331. And pushing this agenda of chivalric regality in England, Edward travelled. At the beginning of May in 1331, he and his men took part in a tournament at Dartford. It was hosted by a man called William Clinton, and Edward fought as a knight on Clinton's side. Now, this is the first recorded instance of him taking part in a tournament as a common knight, not as the king. In putting himself at risk, he was encouraging his knights to respect him for his bravery and valour, not just his rank. 1 month after this, he took part in another tournament at Stepney, a 4-day event held to celebrate the first birthday of his son, Edward of Woodstock. The event was organised by a man called Roger Morley, who fought against all comers with 15 men, all dressed in green cloaks decorated with golden arrows. Now, tournaments themselves were changing. They were becoming far more organised affairs. If you went back to what a tournament was in the century before, you could have had up to 3,000 men taking part in a grand melee, and the melee itself would have covered a huge area, like an entire field. In the 14th century, tournaments took place in more confined spaces. Sometimes wooden castles would be built, with one team attacking and one team defending it. And since the tournament now became a celebration, there'd be dancing, feasting and drinking as well. That became ritualised and part of it. Tournaments usually took place over 3 days. The participants being introduced and paraded on the first day, jousting on the second, and the tournament itself on the final day. And there were judges and prizes awarded to those who could distinguish themselves. I mean, it's not clear how they managed to judge a melee, and even the scoring system for jousts varied. Generally, the highest score was given to knocking your opponent off his horse, the next highest for breaking a lance on the opponent, and the lowest for striking the opponent's helmet. And the knights would have, usually, 3 runs on each other. But tournaments were not as profitable as they'd once been. During the grand melees of previous centuries, if you could capture somebody in a fight and a tournament, you could ransom them. That wasn't allowed anymore. So even though there were prizes, they weren't very big. And tournaments could backfire on you, especially if you cheated. Back in 1307, Piers Gaveston, Edward II's favourite, held a tournament to celebrate his marriage. A bunch of people turned up looking for the melee, but then Piers brought 3 times more the number of men he said he would bring, and so kicked the crap out of everybody and won. And then a few weeks later, when King Edward held a tournament to celebrate his marriage to Isabella of France, Piers turned up and did exactly the same thing. Then during the coronation tournament, Piers Gaveston asked the king to cancel that because he'd heard a rumour that everybody was going to turn up with all their blokes and they were intending just to kick the crap out of him. So anyway, back in 1331, after the tournaments in Dartford and Stepney, in late September, yet another tournament was declared, this time at the invitation of a man called William Montague. But what made this tournament different was that it was to be held in the very centre of the city of London, upon Cheapside. This is awesome. The whole brand new majestic Arthurian Missos Lace spectacle was now to be played out on the street Thomas Becket had grown up on. The preparations were immense. The street was closed, maybe not all of it, maybe just the region between Wood Street and Queen Street. And masses of sawdust and other materials were placed upon the street to prevent the horses from slipping. And also, based upon a plethora of ordinances we have seen written down over the years, we can be fairly sure that before that ever happened, the usually filthy street had been given a deep clean to remove all the rubbish, animal entrails, detritus and human shit that covered it. Above all, as this was being set up, a large wooden stand was erected, built by London's carpenters, to allow the ladies of the court and honoured guests sit and have the best seats in the house. And then the whole ritual began. After a mass sung in memory of the late King Edward II, and money had been given out to the paupers of London in his name, Edward joined Montague and his other chosen knights in dressing as Tartars and leading in procession, quote, the most noble and beautiful women of the realm, unquote, all dressed in red velvet tunics with white hoods, colours of St. George, and each woman was led by a silver chain attached to a knight's right hand. So let's get this right here. The king was not quite in blackface, but it was bloody close. I mean, he's dressed as a Tartar or a Mongol warrior. One wonders if it was just his outfit or if he and the lads were wearing false moustaches or masks. Edward himself led his sister Eleanor in the procession, but it should be noted that not all the women in the procession were nobles' daughters. Several of them were the daughters of ladies of the merchant class. This is quite novel in English history. And as to why, well, there's a lot of references for how beautiful they were, but actually, it's noted that over in Hainaut, in Flanders, it was quite normal for nobility to fraternise with the richer merchants over there. So this idea of inviting in rich merchants' daughters to join with nobles' daughters may have been inspired by Queen Philippa. Either way, this extension of royal favour to the merchant class was a big development in Edward's reign, and it would lead to many merchants and mayors of London being knighted. They liked theirs. The tournament was to have 13 knights, which were to be engaged on each side, and they were being led out before the cheering crowds, and scarcely had the finely dressed ladies of the court taken their seats on the high wooden tower when the scaffolding suddenly gave way and the whole structure collapsed. there must have been bedlam. Now, the reports of this event differs on account to account, book to book. What we can say is that no one was killed when the stand collapsed. I have some sources maintain no one was injured either, while others say people were injured, but not too seriously. Clearly, anyone who had experiences had probably been terrified. There was absolute confusion ensuing afterwards. When the young king saw this danger to his beloved wife, he flew into a furious rage and swore that the careless carpenters who'd built this bloody thing should be brought to justice and instantly hung. Now, the classic version of events say that at this moment, Queen Philippa, scarcely recovered from the terror of her fall, threw herself upon her knees before the incensed king and pleaded for the pardon of the poor men. And Edward became pacified and he forgave them. It seems typical of the myth of Queen Philippa that she should ask for mercy. And it's also typical of Edward that he would immediately respond to any kind of disaster with a show of force. But Edward did spare the workmen. Ultimately, it did not matter to him whether they lived or died, just that he was the one who made that decision. Perhaps the most telling aspect of the young king's character is that despite the near death of his wife, he ordered the tournament would continue. Edward was a young man who needed to control events. And though he may not have decided to hang the negligent workmen, nothing was going to stop him from holding the tournament he said would be held. And thus, Cheapside became, briefly, the centre of a mythic, majestic show. Rich velvets and silks have trailed along the streets. Jewels shone from rich patrons. Spearheads and axe heads glittered in the tournament. Breastplates and steel claps gleamed. Proud horses charged. The mob cheered. The mayor and the aldermen swelled with pride. London must have been majestic. There's a little footnote to this story that's overlooked by many. The king apparently decided after this that for any future similar events in Cheapside, he wasn't going to risk his queen's life in the hands of those bloody incompetent London carpenters. Oh no. Instead, he commissioned the stonemasons of the city to build a permanent grandstand at the best vantage point, which was beside the church of St. Mary Le Bow, fit for royalty with all the comforts and shelter from the weather. And this was to be known as the Crown Sild. We don't know, actually, how often royalty made use of the Crown Sild. Tournaments were held more frequently up at Smithfield, outside of the city walls, where there was far more space for crowds. But the procession of the monarch on the eve of their coronation always travelled from the Tower of London to Westminster Palace via Cheapside, so the citizens could see their new king and queen. And the Sild would have been the best viewpoint. As well as that, we know there were other processions and pageants and street festivals and entertainments that took place on Cheapside that weren't tournaments. And we also know that the last royal spectators to use the Royal Sild for such an event were Henry VIII and his queen Anne Boleyn. And thus, the Crown Sild stood on Cheapside. By the late 15th century, when not in use by, you know, VIPs, the lower levels were being rented out to the Vintners' Company and used for the storage of barrels of wine. The Crown Sild remains one of those wonderful aspects of London's history that are now lost to us. And I must admit, every time I see the Lord Mayor's Parade, and the next one's due this November, I always feel it sad that we do not have a recreation of the Crown Sild somewhere like on the corner of Honey Lane, say, but that's just me. London in the years that followed this grand tournament seemed cut off from events elsewhere in the realm. And there was a lot going on elsewhere in the realm, but our city was trying its best to run and regulate itself and cope with changes in the community. I mean, regulation in London took many forms. A few years earlier in 1329, for example, London issued new regulations on fishing in the Thames. The all-powerful fishmongers were decidedly unhappy that rival fishermen from the towns nearby London were overfishing the river. Residents from the villages of Erith, Dagenham and Rainham were arraigned before the mayor and aldermen of the city, accused of fishing the river with nets with half-inch holes in them, as opposed to the standard London 1.5-inch nets. This had allowed them to catch fry, something London's fishermen were forbidden from doing, with the side effect it was impacting on the fish population. These poor fishermen of these villages were hit by huge fines, which were remitted, as there's no way they could afford the huge things, but their nets were seized and burned on Cheapside. By 1333, we see London issue another ban on slaughtering animals in the city's main streets. This was directed principally at the butchers over at Eastcheap and Newgate. Shops which sold the bowels and tripe were also restricted to side streets. And interestingly enough, there was also during the same years as the Cheapside tournament, the origin of one of today's four inns of court, Lincoln's Inn. This was a lodging owned by Thomas of Lincoln, himself a lawyer, on the south side of Holborn. From about this year, he was letting them out to, quote, apprentices in law, unquote. At least that's one theory. We're not 100% sure when Lincoln's Inn was established. The creation by Thomas de Lincoln is one theory, and there's another that the name came from Henry de Lacy, the third Earl of Lincoln, who died back in 1311. He owned property in the area and may have been a patron of the inn. Either way, we think that whomever gave it its name, it was a small inn at Castle Yard, a road that no longer exists, somewhere to the east of Chancery Lane. An inn, by the way, doesn't mean bar, it just means a general lodging place. By 1335, London decided to rebuild and remake the Fleet Prison as it was falling into disrepair in today's Farringdon Street, just north of Ludgate Circus. The man who ran the prison, the keeper of the Fleet, was a Crown appointee, and because some of the prisoners were not always criminals like in Newgate Prison, but quite often were those who in some way offended the king, the post could be quite profitable, as those type of people often had money to make their lives comfortable in captivity, and the keeper was entitled to any payments made by them. By 1335, John de Putney had been replaced as mayor by John de Preston and Reginald de Conduit while also holding his third and fourth terms, and the city seemed much more calmer than it had been. Getting back to the business of business. And yet, events up in Scotland and over the Channel in France are about to plunge England into a new war. Edward III's military reputation was being made, and the economy was about to face a new crisis, paying for Edward III's military reputation being made. All hell was about to break out, and the accident at the tournament was to be forgotten in the stream of events to come. Normal people's lives were about to be undone by the actions of the great and good of the realm. And we will continue that next chapter. Speaking of which, next chapter is one I'm looking forward to, because I'm going to avoid the great and the good. I'm going to avoid the epic tales. I want to talk about normal people. Next chapter, I think, is going to be a special, where we just try and bring to life some of the people living in London in this era. Be that as it may, I hope you enjoyed this one and you could follow along. The Story of London is a free podcast. We run no advertising, but we depend upon generous donations given by listeners and to those who have given us donations, including a recent one by Mark. Thank you so much. It is so appreciated. Back again next week for the 119th chapter of The Story of London. Good gracious. Thanks for listening. Bye.